With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This book is trying to get at the root of, I think, is what is probably the biggest ideal in democratic societies.
This is Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Oliver Wiseman, CapEx's editor. My guest this week is Cass Sunstein, a professor at Harvard Law School and one of America's most prominent and prolific academics. Cass is best known for Nudge, which he wrote more than a decade ago with Richard Thaler. Its publication launched a policy revolution, which I think makes it one of the most consequential books of recent decades. Thaler won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2017, and he and Cass's application of behavioral economics to public policy questions has changed the way governments think about problems ranging from cancer diagnosis to why people don't save enough. The UK has been at the cutting edge of the Nudge revolution, with Whitehall's Behavioral Insights team putting into practice the central Nudge insight that there are ways in which government can improve people's decision-making without resorting to bans, taxes, and mandates. Cass joined me down the line from his office in Massachusetts. I started by asking him about On Freedom, his new book in which he takes the Nudge argument further, claiming we need to redefine freedom of choice altogether. Okay, well, let's start with a quote from the book, which is, freedom of choice should be cherished, but cherishing it is hardly enough. I think that's a good way into your argument. Why don't you explain kind of the basic thesis in On Freedom?
Well, if you have freedom of choice, that's generally very important and crucial, but you might not know how to get to where you want to go. So you might be on a street and driving, and if you don't have directions or a GPS or street signs, you're going to get lost. And we might think, I think we should think, that the problem of navigability is faced by people all over the world, and it is a terrible obstacle to freedom if you can't solve that problem. So if you have a health question and you can't find your way to a doctor who can help you navigate your medical condition, you are to that extent less free. If you are suffering from a problem of economic distress, and one route would be to get job training and get a job, another route would be to get some money, and if you can't find the route, R-O-U-T-E, then you are in a terrible state of unfreedom. So the suggestion is that we often emphasize coercion as a problem, and it sure is, but we often give too little attention to the fact that people often lack a way to get where they want to go.
And this, this obviously follows on very closely from your work on Nudge policies, and the book on that you wrote with Richard Thaler more than a decade ago. What is the piece of the puzzle that this is sort of adding, if you see what I mean?
Well, the word I think that I wish we'd used in the book Nudge is navigability. It has too many syllables, but it gets at a big issue that nudges help solve. So the first goal really is to put on the general agenda the challenge of finding a way to one's preferred destination, and that is something that citizens in all nations face, and that good policies from the public sector and good policies from the private sector often solve. When I worked in the U.S. government, which is something I did for a number of years between this book and the Nudge book, I saw in real time that large companies, small companies, ordinary people would say, you know, what you're suggesting, we don't know if we don't like it even, but we don't know how to do what you're trying to tell us. We don't know exactly what you want us to do to get from here to there. And to see that from the position of the White House kind of put a bright spotlight on something I didn't really see when we were doing Nudge. The other thing I wanted to do with this book is to get a little more ambitious, really, about a defining ideal in all societies. That is the ideal of freedom. And in Nudge, we were emphatic that to preserve freedom of choice is usually a really good idea because people know a lot about the what they care about, and to allow them to find a way to have what they consider to be a good life is a crucial aspect of freedom. But we were really focused on policies and on behavioral science. This book is trying to get at the root of, I think, is what is probably the biggest ideal in democratic societies, and to try to figure out what we might have missed in thinking about coercion as the defining problem.
And so, you think the fairly straightforward cases are ones where people want to get from A to B, and as you say, you're just helping them make that journey. They know that saving for their pension is a good thing, to take a good Nudge example, but you just set up the choice architecture, to use your phrase, in a way that helps them do that. But there are trickier cases, aren't there? I mean, you talk about ones where people have very little self-control. So maybe talk about how should we think about freedom and choice architecture for someone who is, say, a drug addict or a gambling addict, and you know, these are more difficult cases. In your framework.
Yes. And they have urgency because there's acute human suffering that could be remedied, and we ought to get started yesterday. So if someone has a problem with gambling, or if they have a problem with cigarettes, which is, you know, not maybe as severe as the problem with certain kinds of drug addictions, at least. If they're an alcoholic, many people, and I confess I'm one, have people in their families who struggled very seriously with alcoholism. So this is not an abstract thing, though we're talking about an abstract ideal freedom. The challenge for many people who suffer from self-control problems, of which addiction is the most extreme case, is how do we fix that? And to do that, it's as if, for some people with really serious self-control problems, it's as if they're blind and they can't navigate the world. That's a metaphor which some specialists have used to capture the problem of addiction. And to overcome it, really what is needed is something like a GPS device. And many doctors who've had success with addicts, or individuals who've had success in their own lives with self-control problems, it may involve a gambling problem, it may involve romantic behavior, which is not in the interest, let's say, of the people involved, many of them have found a way. And the way might involve development of a new habit. It might involve use of a social network of one kind or another. It might involve constraints that are voluntarily submitted to as a way of ensuring that, you know, there aren't drinks around or there aren't drugs around. And these things are harder than the easy, simple case of, you know, I want to get from one place to another, because for an addict, there really is a desire to get the thing that they're addicted to. Or if you have a self-control problem, you know, you procrastinate, let's say, before you get to work, or you are unable to do something that's in your long-term economic interest, or for a nation, it may have a self-control problem with respect to some environmental or economic problem. People really do want to do the thing now. That is, they want to do the thing that they enjoy now, or to avoid the pain of now, which would involve long-term gain. So it's not as simple a case as a GPS device. And there is an account of freedom, which some libertarians would be interested in, which says if someone wants to keep drinking or keep smoking or not save and spend today, that's not a problem. That's how they exercise their freedom. It might be that's too simple because people have in their minds a very clear idea, which is that they're in the grip of something. We say we're in the grip of an addiction, or that some aspect of their own behavior is defeating their capacity for, let's say, long-term freedom. So there's a little war within the self, and people often want the war to be won, let's say, to the side that takes the long-term into account. And they need something like a solution to a navigation problem to do that.
Okay. The British government has actually, been surprisingly, I don't know why I say surprisingly, maybe it's not surprising, but the British government's been at the sort of cutting edge of lots of the nudge stuff with the nudge unit here in Britain. So I'd be interested this is just a general question, but I mean, your experience of what's happened in Britain and the effectiveness of that, and how closely you follow the nudge unit here from over there.
Okay, so in our White House, I had some role in doing a lot of nudge policies, so I saw that close hand from the standpoint of our government, and I was a frequent interlocutor with my British counterparts. David Halpern is a great friend, and I have many friends in the UK Behavioral Insights team, and the occasional visitor to them. I greatly admire them. So their recent report, that is the one for the previous year, shows that they are spectacularly successful, unquestionably one of the world's leaders. And the reason they're so good, in addition to just tremendous talent, is that they are great at identifying problems and thinking what might be, if not a solution, at least a way of denting the problem. So they might think, well, there's a problem that some doctors aren't getting their patients to urgent care cancer treatment quickly enough. And this is not a hypothetical example, this is a real example. So they would notify the doctors who are slower than the usual, that they're slower than the usual. And the doctors see that and they get faster, and they get people in urgent care more quickly. And that's, a spectacular achievement. You're saving some lives there. Or they might see that people aren't switching from one electricity provider to another because inertia is a very powerful force. So send people some communication suggesting that they can save money if they switch. And the communication has had a significant effect in switching people to better energy providers and saving the money. Worldwide, some of the biggest examples of successful nudges actually aren't in the recent report, which has about 40 examples of successful ones, but they're not massive. I'll give you some massive ones. Switching the default for free children's meals in my country from you have to sign up to you're automatically in is giving in any given year between 10 and 13 million children, poor children, access to free school meals. And that's a statistic, but that's a fantastically large effect. In cases that include the UK, shifting from opt-in to a pension plan to opt-out, where you're automatically enrolled, has had a, we're getting a huge increase in participation rates. For programs that involve relief of poverty shifting from a very complicated design to a very simple design is having big effects in increasing participation rates. So what we're seeing is that simplification of complex requirements and switching from opt-in to opt-out regimes, the latter in the context of climate change, by the way, in Germany, produces a big dent in greenhouse gas emissions, because if people are automatically enrolled in greener energy, the percentage of people who opt out is actually quite small. The percentage of people opt in, if you're asked, do you want to go into green energy, is not very big, not because people don't want to be in, but because it's a bother. So whether we're talking about climate change, environmental problems in general, healthcare, or poverty reduction, sometimes we're talking about hundreds of thousands or millions of people.
And I mean, you know, listening to that, it's been a not just a successful idea in theory, but fantastically successful in practice as well over the last decade or so. So, I mean, I assume you still run into some objections to nudging. And if so, what are the most persistent ones?
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Well, I'd say the one I hear most is that it's a form of manipulation. And there's a good moral instinct behind that concern, which is that the government ought not to be manipulating people. It should be respectful of individual dignity. And one of the impetuses, really, for the current book, the book that deals with freedom, is to take the manipulation concern seriously and to use it not as a basis for an argument, really, but as a basis for seeing what paths of interventions are obviously not subject to the manipulation concern. And if you have a GPS device, or if someone who's suffering from mental illness, let's say, is given a route by which they can deal with, let's say, obsessive compulsive disorder or depression, that to say that's a form of manipulation is really hard. There are some forms of nudges where we could have a pretty interesting discussion of whether there's manipulation. If the government isn't transparent about what it's doing, then at least there should be a red flag that's going up if it's affecting people covertly. But many nudge interventions, they're actually educative. They could be a reminder, as in the case of reminding people of the availability of a program, or reminding people that if they don't pay their credit card bills on time, they're going to be suffering from a late fee. Those aren't manipulative reminders. But if you have a default rule that automatically enrolls in some people in something, you don't want to catch people by accident. You want to be clear that they are automatically enrolled. It probably should be clear that the reason they're automatically enrolled is that for most people it's a reasonable idea. But to avoid any risk of trapping people, you want to be clear that they should be allowed to opt out. As I say, we have in our moral ideals, and this unifies a lot of nations. I'm recently back from the Middle East, and the commonalities completely overpower the differences. People believe that there's individual dignity, that each of us should be treated with respect, and they believe that it's important to give people an opportunity to have a good life. And you can see the first as a Kantian theme, and the second you can see as a Benthamite theme. And Kant and Bentham are often thought to be at opposite poles. One believes in, you know, utility, that's Bentham, and the other believes in treating people as ends, not means, that's Kant. And there are wars between these two approaches, not literal wars, thank goodness, but a wars of words. They march hand in hand in saying that, you know, people shouldn't be manipulated. That's often not going to be in their interest, in Benthamite terms, and it's not treating them as ends. The kinds of interventions we're now discussing and the kinds the UK team has been pressing, they don't defend Benthamite principles if they have good consequences, and they typically do. Thank goodness they are testing to make sure. And they don't defend Kantian principles either, because they do treat people with respect, certainly if they're educative. And if they're saving people time, as an opt-out procedure does, or if they're simplifying participation rates, which is something the U.S. team and the U.K. team, Singapore, Canada, Qatar, there's interest in this all over the world, that really increases navigability. So a spotlight maybe that the UK has put on large ideals as well as on daily practice is that if you can help people find their way to their preferred destination, especially if they're suffering or struggling, that is a way of showing them respect. And if you fail to do that, that's disrespectful, and it's likely to have good consequences for people.
And you you invoke Hayek, don't you, in On Freedom, to sort of make the case, I mean, a similar point, about maybe talk about how he sort of, how you work him into this.
Yes, so Hayek is a great hero of mine. He's the greatest critic of socialism ever, and his kind of enduring claim, and I think it's fair to call it a demonstration, is that markets have a lot more information than any government planners can ever have. Not because the planners are stupid or malevolent. Hayek was willing to stipulate that the planners have good motives and they're smart. They're just not going to know as much. So if the market says the price of eggs is X, the market has information from tons of people who are deciding whether to buy the eggs. And that's true for shoes and laptops and cell phones. It's true for all products that have market prices. So that's a very important point, and it argues in favor of freedom-preserving interventions and against coercion, because people can go their own way. This wouldn't suggest, and Hayek didn't believe, that there's no place for coercion. There is a place for coercion. People can't murder each other or rape each other or sexually harass each other. That wasn't in Hayek's time a legal principle, but I think it fits very much with his framework. But where people are trying to find their own way, then to take on board Hayek's point is, I think, a very good idea. Hayek didn't see the point we're now discussing. That is the obstacle to freedom that's posed by challenges of navigability. But I think it's in the spirit of his general framework, let's say, to say that's a gap that he would like to see filled. At least I hope so. The kind of Hayekian twist I would give to my own point is that often a nudger, let's say, or a choice architect will not know as much as the chooser will. And that's a reason for humility. So a chooser might have, over the course of a lifetime, you know, 1,001 things he or she is balancing. You know, I want to be healthy. I want to be thin. I want to love my meals. I really like brownies and chocolate, and pancakes in the morning are great. And I'm trying to balance these things in multiple different ways. And that is, I think, in spirit, it's not high exclaim about markets, but you can think, see an individual, given the assortment of things any one of us cares about, we're a little like a market in our own life in the sense that there's a lot of knowledge we have about a lot of different things we care about. And that is a cautionary note for choice architects. Now, since anyone who runs a website or any government that has a program or any parent who has a child is a choice architect, whether it wants to be or not, we shouldn't say don't do choice architecture, but we can say do choice architecture in a way that's attentive to the diversity of values and preferences that people have. And that argues first and foremost for preserving the freedom of choice, not necessarily for little kids. I have a six-year-old myself, and she gets to do a lot of stuff on her own, but her freedom is not as full as it will be when she is, let's say, 30. But still to have for adults freedom of choice, respecting the diversity of their values and giving them opportunities to go in multiple different directions. So to see the government and the private sector, I think this is also very important, whether it's a credit card company or a insurance company or a hospital or a criminal justice system, where, of course, there's going to be coercion. But in any of these, to see a degree of openness to the challenge people have in navigating these systems with markers that make the experience as simple as possible. And what I want to emphasize is simplification in a way seems like a time saver, but it's much more than that. It's often a lifesaver. It makes all the difference for many people all over the world in whether they go to jail or not, or whether they get a job or not.
Mm. If I could broaden things out a little bit, next, you're you know, listening to you talk there, this is a very data-driven, practical, non-partisan approach to government, and in that sense it seems completely, if you don't mind me saying, it seems completely at odds with the current sort of political mood in America and elsewhere. So you know, is this sort of policymaking kind of possible when, you know, voters can't agree on how many people were at Trump's inauguration, or, you know, when you can't have a shared set of facts that you're talking about? This sort of approach, how do you square those things?
Well, you know, when I was in our government, I saw a disconnect between the daily headlines and what's really going on. So there are daily headlines about tweets from our president, but not long ago, our Department of Transportation reaffirmed a rule which requires cameras in all new cars so that you can see behind you. It's called the rear visibility rule, and it's saving lives. It's a data-driven rule. It's not very expensive, and it prevents small people, children, and often elderly people who can't be seen. It prevents them from getting hit because the drivers can see in back. It's fantastic. It's a lifesaver. The Trump administration didn't just embrace it, and enthusiastically embraced it. The reason is the data. With respect to air pollution, particulate matter is a very bad pollutant, hurts people all over the world, actually produces deaths. The Trump administration has reaffirmed the Obama particulate matter regulation quietly. There's a regulation involving ozone, which is not a very good air pollutant, and the Trump administration has reaffirmed that too. And I won't bore you, but I could say, I could give maybe 740 off the top of the head examples that are just like this. And that's actually pathetic, but true. This is what I used to do in government, so I have 740. And they are accepted by our government because the technical people say, you know, this makes a lot of sense. And the Trump White House, even if the president is tweeting, is not changing it, or they might be doing something that's quiet but that is driven by data. In fact, we just passed a law recently requiring evidence-based policymaking, our Congress, and I'm just back from the Netherlands, which is admittedly not a country that's in the news for being abandoning facts, but the insistence in the Netherlands on fact-based policymaking is completely inspiring and self-evident. And in Germany, the same is true. And I'm not a complete expert on the UK government, and I know there's a lot of noise about some things which don't seem data-driven.
Rather a busy time of it.
But I know many policymakers there who are very quietly, with respect to issues involving safety and health and the environment, they are as insistent on data as you could possibly imagine.
So your point is that there are some policy decisions where the data is just so overwhelmingly in favor of making a certain call that you just, it's not a, you know, anyone would make that call. Is that, that's what you're saying?
I would say that, and I'd put it even more strongly. There are some decisions where the data is disputed, but that the weight of the evidence goes in one direction. And for a dazzling number of cases, it doesn't matter whether you're in one political party or another political party, you go with the weight of the evidence. And I saw in government that happen time and again. Sometimes it meant the Obama administration would go to the right. Sometimes it meant it would go to the left. And notwithstanding the tumult that we're seeing from some recent events in the United States, that is still happening every day. It just doesn't hit the headlines. So I should say that that's an opportunistic cough. I should say that I'm not a tremendous fan of President Trump. I think he's done some good things on balance. I think this is not a terrific moment for U.S. government. In fact, I put it even more strongly than that. In some ways, it's a, you know, very dispiriting moment for the U.S. government, notwithstanding the fact that he's done some good things. But even so, the interest in data-driven policymaking crushes, in the sense of dominates, the interest in intuition-driven policymaking in terms of sheer numbers of choices.
That was Cass Sunstein on Nudges. Thanks for listening.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.